This is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Why is it that when people give a statement to say that Martin Bormann was certainly here, he lived at that address, I mean, come on, Mengele was here, Karl Werner was here, Adolf Eichmann was here, Klaus Barbie was here. I mean, how many need to be here, but the money man's not here?
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. ...130 innocent Parisians murdered, but since most French are against intervention in Syria, what could these attacks hope to achieve? A sophisticated attack in Paris killing 130 innocent Parisians a week ago. But with all the banking and surveillance power of the Western world, how are ISIS able to continue to finance their operations? And if someone had told French intelligence after the Charlie Hebdo attacks in January how ISIS were being financed, don't you think they'd wanted to know? And if they didn't, should they be held partly responsible for last Friday's carnage? Also, geopolitics, anomalies, exercises, fake passports, even a statement from the French police saying it was a sophisticated propaganda operation. But who's sophisticated enough to carry out something like that? And is there any precedent for terrorism across Europe with innocent people being shot dead in the streets in their hundreds? We look at NATO's Operation Gladio from the 1980s and 90s, where hundreds of innocent Europeans were murdered to bamboozle European governments into following US foreign policy. Also, the news agenda conveniently running alongside. It must have been the refugees what done it, really? And massive increases in MI5, GCHQ and the SAS budgets on the back of last Friday's attacks. As well as Cameron's moves to get a vote to bomb Syria but ignore the UN Security Council. So is the Prime Minister trying to outdo Tony Blair as a war criminal? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. But we start this week with Kevin Phillips, chair of the Avon and Somerset Police Federation. Forgot what you were chair of for a minute there, Kevin. It'd be interesting to get immediately your reaction to the news about the increase in the budgets for the secret services, basically for the secret police, whereas you guys, the non-secret police, they're talking now about quite severe cuts. In fact, I saw a headline last week saying no more bobbies on the beat at all.
Yeah, I mean, clearly it's a problem for us is the new budget cuts, which are due to be announced probably next week. Increase in security services, I think that's a knee-jerk reaction as to what's happened last week in Paris. And I say it was a dreadful thing that happened there. And clearly we do have to prevent things happening like that. But if you get a determined terrorist, and I'll use the word terrorist, turning up on your doorstep, I don't think anything that we do secret service wise is going to stop that.
Well, there's already been big increases, Martin, haven't there, in secret service budgets since the end of the Cold War, and yet this couldn't be prevented. And we will be talking a bit more later about the finance side of this, but I wonder what struck you most about the Paris attacks, the way they were carried out, and also the reporting of them.
Well, I mean, as you know, Tony, I think what we need to do is actually beef up the non-secret police to investigate these events.
Well, why is that? What's the difference?
Well, because as you mentioned earlier, in Operation Gladio, there is actually a track record of the secret services of NATO being implicated in these events. I'm not jumping to any conclusions about what happened in Paris, but in the past, they were implicated in fomenting these events. Al-Qaeda was set up by MI6 under Operation Cyclone, initially to channel Islamic dissidents from all over the Middle East to Pakistan and then into Afghanistan, all paid for by British taxpayers, all done by our secret service.
Can I just point to the Petiano massacre, for example, in the late 70s in Italy, where the secret services were employing fascists to actually kill civil police in Italy to create a strategy of tension.
Indeed, and we know a lot about what happened in Italy because the civil police force basically got their act together and over decades have carried out investigations pointing the fingers fairly clearly at elements within the secret security forces for being behind those terrorist incidents. And I would see the way forward, frankly, as not being chucking money at unaccountable secret services, but empowering the civil police force to properly investigate all lines of investigation after these terrible events.
Now, the cutbacks in the police budget was actually mentioned at Prime Minister's questions earlier this week. Just before we hear from PMQs, from I think it's Ron Marsden, is it, one of your representatives, Police Federation people in the House of Commons. I wonder what you make of and what you know about what may be being announced in the autumn statement about policing next week, Kevin.
Well, I mean, clearly the figures are going up to potentially 20%, 30% further budget cuts. Many people are saying we could cope with 5%. I don't think we can actually cope with 5%. If you look at what happened in Paris last week and in France, they have a population of 66 million people, 250,000 cops. In this country, we're looking at 64 million population and 130,000 cops. Now, if they're going to start cutting those, how do we manage to police anything?
Good question. Anyway, let's go back to Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday to hear Ron Marsden MP's question to the Prime Minister on this topic.
Mr. Gordon Marsden.
Mr. Speaker, may I associate myself, and I hope the whole House, with what the Prime Minister and others from the government have said about the attacks in Paris. No man or woman is an island. People from Blackpool were among those murdered on a Tunisian beach, and our tower was lit in red, white and blue like other places worldwide for those killed by the terrorists in France. Now, Mr. Speaker, I raised concerns with the Prime Minister here 2 weeks ago about neighbourhood policing and security being threatened by the scale of proposed cuts and the Lancashire funding formula, which has now been admitted as flawed. Can I ask him to reflect on the words, "When facts change, I change my mind," and when police local intelligence can be crucial against terrorists, perhaps this isn't the time to jeopardise it with arbitrary Treasury targets for cuts.
Minister.
Well, first of all, thank you very much. Can I thank the Honourable Gentleman for what he says about Paris and the importance of the whole House coming together over this issue. And on policing, what I'd say to the Honourable Gentleman is that we have, quite rightly, in this Parliament, protected counter-terrorism policing. We're going to protect that again in this Parliament. What we've done in terms of policing otherwise is we've seen an increase in neighbourhood officers of 3,800 over the Parliament, and we've seen a 31% cut in crime. Let me commend the police, not just counter-terrorism police, but all police for the work that they do, and we'll announce our proposals in terms of police spending next week.
I think if Mr. Cameron wants to come to Avon and Somerset, we'd quite happily point out that the neighbourhood police officers that he's talking about, the increase in police officers, are actually working on response teams. They are filling in the gaps. They are covering all the shortages that we have. And I can speak from experience, having spoken to many of my members on that.
When you talk about response teams, just go into the detail a little bit about what you mean by that, because I think, you know, maybe we're not quite sure how things work behind the scenes with the police.
Yes, effectively, within the stations that we've got at the moment, you will have neighbourhood policing, the beat teams, the beat managers with community police officers and etc. like that. Then you have the response teams, which deal with the 999 calls, the emergency calls, and respond to incidents as they occur.
Martin, again, it looks like it's bad news for the civil police, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and I think I think there's a case for keeping the police effective within communities, because of course if you've built up trust and relationships over many years, you lose that trust and relationships because you haven't got the time to make the contacts and so on. It takes years to rebuild them, so that's, you know, it's a false economy in many respects.
But I mean, in some ways there has been a loss of trust with the police, Kevin, I have to say. I mean, you know, we've got the Northern Echo. It's just something that I came across earlier this week, as Northern Echo journalists' phone records have been accessed arrest by Cleveland police. This is a story up in the Northern Echo themselves, writing a newspaper article about how the police have been scanning their journalists' phone records, and they're not happy about it. Also, of course, we've got the news today and the ongoing, I think it's, I'm not quite, is it Pitchford inquiry, I believe, into this aggressive style of policing where undercover officers were going into environmental groups and targeting individuals that weren't even actually breaking the law, certainly not breaking the criminal law, and even having children with them. So, you know, it's not surprising that you're losing the trust in some ways of the public, Kevin.
I can see where the problems are on some things like that. I mean, that is why we had the Regulation of Investigative Powers Act 2000, which was brought in to try and cover all these aspects, the undercover officers, the phone tappings and everything else like that. Clearly before then we had the Inception of Communications Act 1985, which obviously had major problems because it breached human rights. It breached the, Article 8 of the Human Rights Act.
I mean, the thing is, there will be people who look at what happened with these environmental groups, these undercover officers, basically hacking people's lives in the most appalling fashion. I think one woman was given £400,000 compensation. But then, of course, these police officers ordered these operations without thinking that this would be permanently kept secret. No one would ever know that a police officer, and it's actually only a whistleblower police officer, that has made this public and made sure they have to pay this compensation with surveillance. Particularly, we're looking at a kind of Big Brother state, Kevin. You know, this is what we don't want. Is we don't want to move into that kind of police state area.
Most certainly, I know where you're coming from. There's always going to be a few incidents turn up. Quite rightly, whenever any of these operations have been instructed and commenced, it's been with the most senior officers authorising those events and those actions. I still think the police service in this country, police by consent, as Robert Peel said, you know, we are the police, the people are the police as well. You know what I mean? It's all part and parcel of that.
Police state, no one wants to see that, and it seems that it's coming closer and closer, Kevin. What can you, as the Police Federation, assuming you want to, do to reverse that trend?
I think part of the problems I see from where I sit is I don't think we're becoming a police state. I think we will eventually become a two-tier police system. You will have the what I would class as the regular police officers as we are now, dealing with all the violent, high-level crimes that we do. And you're going to have the, for example, the police and community officers looking after the community systems there.
Yeah, well, hang on a minute, because you don't, do you? We've got the VI paedophile scandal with some very high-level people who are still walking the streets, using their political influence for impunity, effectively, like Pinochet's Chile. They're walking the streets while their victims are being classed effectively as... they're having a kind of double victim. Not only have they been violated by these people, but now they're going around with no justice, and also sometimes they're being blamed simply for coming forward to the police. A lot of people are actually afraid to come forward to the police with allegations against powerful people. Then on the other side of it, you've got what we were hearing earlier on about Iceland. Now, Iceland is a country way off in the North Sea. It's getting pretty chilly there this time of year, but it's around about the same population as the Greater Bristol area, if you can think about it like that. What they've done is they've found all the bankster fraudsters and they've stuck them in jail. In Britain, what we seem to do is we reward them with bonuses. So why aren't your officers doing something about those two particular problems?
And I think, as I linked into earlier, with any of the undercover actions that are taken, any of the undercover operations that are taken, these come from a very high level within the police service. And I think if you went round any rank and file police officer, they would agree with exactly what you're saying, that we should be targeting everybody.
But, I mean, if you talk about the high level of the police service around here, we're talking about Nick Gargan, aren't we, really? I mean, he's the former chief constable who was really, I suppose it was a campaign against him because of whatever reasons. But, I mean, he was suspended for 6 months, wasn't he? We had also a tremendous amount of evidence, certainly of on this show, we've put together a bit of a dossier, really, about the various methods that were used to get rid of him. One of them, for example, was the campaign which was led by Colin Port, the former chief constable. There were people from that campaign that were actually threatening journalists at the BBC. So the BBC had to bring down private security, I'm not sure if you knew that, to protect journalists who were covering the case, because the campaigners against Nick Gargan had been actually threatening journalists. In fact, to such an extent they had to get private security to protect them.
I think it's quite an interesting position to be in there, because, I mean, you name former Chief Constable Colin Port, David Shattuck, Steve Pilkington. I'm aware of the letter that they sent with regards to Nick Gargan. When you actually look at it, whilst I understand where you're coming from as a campaign, I think my name was at the bottom of the first letter that went public, which I was quite happy to actually send that letter and make that as a public document.
Well, I mean, what happened effectively to Gargan, Nick Gargan, was, and I understand now he's under a gagging clause, so we'll probably never hear his side of the story. We heard very little of it through the Evening Post, that's for sure. Is that effectively what happened to him was a phishing operation. There were accusations which were then proved baseless, at least certainly nothing that they could be used against him. And what happened was all of his information was then trawled, his digital signature trawled around, and then some other things were found which were very minor cases. A judge then ruled that he should have his job back, but someone somewhere, someone rather powerful, has decided no.
Well, I think it all went down to the legislation that the current government voted in, and as Dr. Tim Brain clearly said, the former Chief Constable of Gloucester, if they brought the legislation in, they clearly didn't read the small print, because it gave the power to the PCC to actually require him to resign.
Yes, but Sue Mount Stevens could quite easily have done exactly what the judge asked her to do, and that is to give him his job back and put him back in charge of our police.
I think you've got to look at the loss of confidence in somebody in such a high position, where you're talking about, you know, you're talking about the banks and having what goes on at the top there with the banks. If you've got a leader of an organisation that is supposed to be effectively whiter than white, he should have that confidence.
Why a loss of confidence over him sending a few texts about having nights out?
I don't think it had anything to do. The loss of confidence wasn't the fact that he was sending the texts. The loss of confidence was the fact that he had 8 counts of misconduct against him. And in my position as chair of Avon and Somerset Police Federation, if I had 8 counts of misconduct against me, I wouldn't be sat in that chair.
Well, you might well be, actually, because gross misconduct is a sackable offence. I hope you defend your officers in that case. If gross misconduct is a sackable offence, misconduct is not, you would argue for someone who'd been done for misconduct to keep their job.
I certainly would, but I also think that if I had 8 counts of misconduct, I think I would be probably losing
my
job.
And do you think those 8 counts were major or minor? You're sending things from your text phone, sending emails, that sort of thing.
I know what the 8 counts of misconduct were, but if you actually work it out, we sent our letter before we were aware of the 8 counts of misconduct. We knew that there was 8 counts of misconduct, and as far as we were concerned, the 8 counts counted as a vote of no confidence.
Well, that's a bit naughty, because you jumped the gun, didn't you?
Absolutely.
Before you actually knew what this was about, you were saying, no, we've got no confidence in this chap.
No,
but I mean, you know, there's a bigger thing going on here, Kevin, surely, in that you've got an old guard of former chief constables who've decided they don't like the new broom. And that's exactly what Sue Mount Stevens was elected to do, to bring in a new broom.
I think when you look at it, I think the old guard, as you put it, didn't make themselves public till well after the Police Federation, the Superintendents Association, Unison, and National Association of Retired Police Officers made their views known. And Sue took account of that.
Okay, can you just name one thing that Nick Gargan did that meant that he deserved being sacked, a specific thing?
Well, it's quite interesting that there's many things about data protection, and the only reason he couldn't be dealt with for criminally on data protection was because he was the data controller. Now, does that sound right? That somebody who is the data controller can actually have control of the data and use it?
And do you think the IPCC inquiry into his suspension was done correctly? Because certainly by all accounts I can see, it was done in a very, very one-sided manner, where they weren't really interested in listening to what Nick Gargan had to say.
I think it was a very long, drawn-out investigation. I mean, you mentioned being suspended for 6 months. It was actually near 18 months the investigation took place. It took way, way too long. It should have been dealt with quicker and just dealt with.
And would you like to hear him all over the local media talking about his side of the story now it's all over, or do you think he should have this gagging clause?
I wouldn't have an issue if Nick Gargan was able to speak in the media. It's not an issue to me.
It would be nice to hear him, but he can't. Anyway, if you're listening, Nick, we'd love to hear from you. Come down and do an interview, even if you're prepared to risk losing probably, I don't know, thousands of pounds from breaking a gagging clause. We'd love to hear your side of the story. Also, Kevin, this week, City frauds cuts are blamed for a drop in police investigations. Funding cuts have seen the number of economic crime cases. This is going back to the banksters again. Yeah. Investigated by the City of London Police dropped by more than a quarter in the last 4 years. The specialist white-collar police force investigated 777 economic crimes. I'm glad it wasn't 666, but anyway, in the year. The specialist, those are the specialist white-collar police force, that's up till March 2012, but that fell to just 563 this year, according to a study by the law firm Pinsent Mason. The force's budget has only been cut by 15% over the last 5 years, and stand at 121 million. So even less investigation of the banksters. This is what I call them. This is people who are committing fraud in the City of London, because we're fast getting to the position where the only reason that London is staying as a big financial centre is because you can do almost anything you want there and you'll never be prosecuted.
I would probably say you're probably right on what goes on in the City of London. Why the investigations have fallen, why the level of investigations have fallen, only they can answer, really. It's just one of those things that, you know, how much can you do at the time?
Martin, the City of London Police are doing even less fraud investigations now, and even less chance of nailing bankers for committing fraud. Am I exaggerating to say that the Mansion House people in there on Monday night are the people that really run the country, and also that they've got this kind of almost magic wand of impunity where they can do what they want to bring as much money as possible to London, and that they can commit crime even?
Well, we've had on this show in the past...
Rowan Bosworth Rowan Davis, Bosworth are you Davis. Talking about? Oh, yes, because he was a City of London
was a Met Fraud
detective,
Squad officer in the 1990s, and he's now an academic criminologist, and he's done a study where he looks at the banking and financial sector, and he uses four different methodologies for an organised crime syndicate. He uses the EU methodology, the British methodology, the US methodology, and the Australian methodology, and he shows how banking organisations like HBOS and HSBC fulfil all of the criteria for criminal organised criminal activity. And I think what's happened over the years is that we've just become inured to this. In Iceland, of course, they've prosecuted their top bankers. In Britain, if they were to start prosecuting, they'd probably have to prosecute everybody. And since we can't prosecute everybody, we're not going to prosecute anybody. But of course, ultimately, and this of course links into things like the international drugs trade and so on, where, you know, teenagers are arrested for possession of cannabis, whereas banks which money launder for the Mexican drug cartels get a slap on the wrist, and that's the reality.
It sounds to me, Kevin, like you've got this too big to jail. You've got quite a lot of people in this country who are too rich and powerful, and they are never going to get their collars felt by people like you.
I think the difficulty is you're going to get corruption anywhere, and wherever you find it, you're not always going to be able to deal with it.
But that means there has to be corruption within the police force for those people not to be properly investigated and not to be prosecuted.
I'd like to think there's bound to be issues within the police service, but I wouldn't say there's corruption in the police service. I think we are regulated quite strictly, and what we do is always open to be viewed and looked at.
It's scrutiny, really. I mean, I can't get into a police station and scrutinise it. But anyway, let's finish off with this whole business of shoot to kill. This has become a big national debate over a couple of days this week after the Paris attacks. Should police officers be given the right to shoot to kill, or should they be shooting to maim, bring someone down and bring them to trial?
I think it's quite an interesting terminology, is the shoot to kill, because I actually think if you're actually pulling the trigger, that is the aim that you are doing.
Well, no, not necessarily, because you could be shooting at somebody's legs to bring them down. You could be shooting, you know, maybe you'd have a taser or something to... surely the whole point of the police is you're going to bring someone to justice, not blow them away.
No, I think what you've got to look at is Section 3 of the 1967 Criminal Law Act, which says a person may use such force as is reasonable at the time to prevent crime. That's one section of it. Now, if you are faced with somebody that's about to take your life or take somebody else's life, why shouldn't you have the right to shoot them?
Martin?
I think that's right. If you're going to use a firearm, you've got to use it to kill. Yeah. The idea that you're going to use it to disable somebody is a red herring. On the other hand, I would say, particularly in these terrorist cases, the overwhelming priority should be to take people alive, because then they can be interrogated.
Well, this and is
then
the
you
problem,
can
isn't
find
it?
Out who's been... You see, one of the problems, we're going to go on to discuss yeah. Paris, but virtually everybody who's been implicated in this attack has now ended up dead, including the so-called suicide bomber woman who was...
I don't know if you noticed from a legal point of view, but as soon as there was the attack yesterday morning, whenever it was a couple of days ago, early in the morning, and the so-called mastermind who'd been floated out as a mastermind was called the alleged mastermind. As soon as
he
is now the mastermind, and everything is being rolled out.
And he is now dead, and will never stand trial, and never be interrogated by a police officer. In the 7/7 attacks, Haruna Swat was named by the then investigating officer
John Loftus. Are you talking?
No, I'm talking about when
Andy Heyman.
No. When what was his name? Who was still in charge of the investigation? The guy who used to be head of Brixton Police, you know, and who eventually became a political figure. Doesn't matter. But anyway, but he pointed. He named Haruna Swat as the
Paddock. Is it Paddock?
Paddock. Yeah. He named Haruna Swat. And Haruna Swat, we understand, was on the phone to all of the alleged bombers the week before. He was then, he was one of the few people in Britain who were put under administrative detention. So he wasn't interviewed, he wasn't put on trial. He was then supposedly had mental health issues and was put in Broadmoor. And he's now been extradited to the US. Now, if, as I suspect, NATO intelligence services are either... by commission or omission involved in these attacks, then killing all of the so-called terrorists leads to a situation where no further investigation needs to be carried out. So in other words, there's no further investigation needs to be carried out. We're bombing Syria, that's because it's ISIS who did it, and all of the people who might have told us who recruited them, how they were recruited, where they got their weaponry from, are all dead.
There was a big hoo-ha over the Gibraltar killings of the IRA cell, wasn't there? That was the whole shoot to kill
Well, I mean, there was no justification for shooting those people because they were unarmed. The Spanish police have made that absolutely clear. They were unarmed and they were shot out of hand. Now that shouldn't happen.
So how
anyway.
Does someone make a decision, Kevin, as a police officer with a firearm in their hand, as to whether someone is a danger to them or not? I mean, I'm reminded of the killing of John Charles de Menezes on the underground train just after the 7/7 bombings. The police, it seems, were very trigger happy there. The guy had no way of harming the police whatsoever, yet they just blew him away on an underground train.
Yeah, and I fully expected that to be raised, actually. Clearly, occasionally mistakes do happen. And when you actually look at that, because if you actually looked at that case specifically, as with any terrorist, the aim is not to shoot. As a normal firearms operation, you would shoot for the main body mass, the chest, effectively. Mm. But on any terrorist shooting, you would always aim for the head, because they may well have... explosive structure on the bodies.
But he didn't, did he? He was just an ordinary electrician sitting on a train. Why did he deserve to die?
I'm not saying he deserved to die. What I'm saying is that clearly mistakes do happen, and that was one mistake.
Cressida Dick, who was in charge of that operation, then got promoted afterwards. I mean, what does that tell you about the way things work in the police? She should be sacked and prosecuted, not promoted.
I think you've got to look at what the intelligence is that comes in and how you use it. And
Martin?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are you know, borderline cases where we could argue that somebody shouldn't be shot or because
well, that's Charles de Menezes is not
what,
a borderline case.
What worries
case,
me about the deaths of the terrorists in Paris yesterday, or the same with the Madrid train bombing, or of other bombings we've seen in the past, is that the investigation stops there.
So you've got a problem, haven't you, Kevin? Because dead men tell no tales.
That is exactly the point. If they've been set up to be patsies by somebody else, then we're never going to find out now. And of course, the narrative has now been taken over by the government and the media, not by the investigating police officers. And I think that's what we got in Italy, because of the system they have of magistrates having inquisitorial powers, is that these events started to happen in the late 60s and early 70s in Italy, bombs going off in restaurants, but, you know, in banks and so on. And the police at first went along with the general view, this must be these crazy people, we'll have to look in it. But as time went on, they began to realise that there was a pattern to this, and they started to properly investigate. And of course, you need, I mean, obviously it's not always possible to preserve somebody's life if they're a danger to themselves or others, or the officers who are trying to arrest them. But on the other hand, I should think it should be a priority to arrest people alive, not just because we want to keep people alive. They should, if bin Laden was really killed in Pakistan, many Pakistanis don't believe that for a moment, by the way, including the ones who live around here, then surely you should arrest him so that you can find out what's
happened. Kevin, we're in a difficult situation with this whole shoot-to-kill business, where police can just shoot and kill somebody just on the notion that they might be a threat, and there's very little checking done into it afterwards. And people get off, for example, in the Mark Duggan killing in London.
I think what you've got to look at within this country is totally different to most of the European countries. The majority of firearms operations that people get involved in, there has to be the authority to use the firearms weapons. It is down to the discretion of the officer that's carrying the weapon. They make the decision should there be lives in danger.
Okay, Kevin Phillips, Chair of Avon and Somerset Police Federation, thanks very much for joining us here on The Politics Show.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Now, immediately after the Paris shootings, in fact, not immediately, a couple of days afterwards, Prime Minister David Cameron strolled into the House of Commons to give a statement about it. So we'll have a listen to that now and get Martin's comments after it's finished.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. With permission, I would like to make a statement on the terrorist attack in Paris and the G20 in Turkey this weekend. On Paris, the Home Secretary gave the House the chilling statistics yesterday, and now we know that among the victims was a 36-year-old Briton, Nick Alexander, who was killed at the Bataclan. I know the thoughts and prayers of the whole House will be with the families and the friends of all those affected. On Saturday, I spoke to President Hollande to express the condolences of the British people and our commitment to help in whatever way we can. Mr. Speaker, after our horror and our anger must come our resolve and our determination to rid our world of this evil. So let me set out the steps we're taking to deal with this terrorist threat. The more we learn about what happened in Paris, the more it justifies the full spectrum approach that we've discussed before in this House. When you're dealing with radicalised European Muslims linked to ISIL in Syria and inspired by a poisonous narrative of extremism, you need an approach that covers the full range: military power, counter-terrorism expertise, and defeating the poisonous narrative that is the root cause of this evil. Let me take each in turn. First, we should be clear that this murderous violence requires a strong security response. That means continuing our efforts to degrade and destroy ISIL in Syria and Iraq, and where necessary, it means working with our allies to strike against those who pose a direct threat to the safety of British people around the world. Together, coalition forces have now damaged over 13,500 targets. We've helped local forces to regain 30% of ISIL territory in Iraq. We've helped to retake Kobani and push ISIL back towards Raqqa. And on Friday, Kurdish forces retook Sinjar. The UK is playing its part, training local forces, striking targets in Iraq, and providing vital intelligence support. Last Thursday, the United States carried out an airstrike in Raqqa, Syria, targeting Mohammed Edwazi, the ISIL executioner known as Jihadi John. This was a result of months of painstaking work in which America and Britain worked hand in glove to stop this vicious murderer. Mr. Speaker, it is important that the whole House understands the reality of the situation we are in. There is no government in Syria we can work with, particularly not in that part of Syria. There are no rigorous police investigations or independent courts upholding justice in Raqqa. We have no military on the ground to detain those preparing plots against our people. In this situation, we do not protect the British people by sitting back and wishing that things were different. We have to act to keep our people safe, and that is what this government will always do.
There's an awful lot of boilerplate in that presentation. and a lot of begging of questions. The Prime Minister said that because of the interventions by Western powers, local forces have retaken 30% of the ground covered by ISIS. Now, who are those local forces that he's referring to? Because he's certainly not referring to the Syrian Arab Army, which has taken 60,000 casualties in its struggle against all extremists in Syria in the last 4 years. When the bombs at Suruk and in Ankara killed more people than were killed in Paris, the local understanding of the Kurdish forces there was that the Turkish military intelligence, MIT, were firmly in cahoots with ISIS. Now, Turkey is an integral part of NATO. Saudi Arabia and Qatar are our allies. They are the three main backers of ISIS. So at the very least, we can say that what happened in Paris, very regrettable events that happened in Paris, the very least we can say, as the Russians and the Syrians have been pointing out, is you have been backing these people and now they've turned on you. But of course the suspicion is worse than that, and I'm afraid, having looked at all the detail coming out of Paris, it fits a pattern of things we've been seeing for decades, whereby terrible events are either made to happen or allowed to happen so that certain political effects can be created. So now we are there's a lot, public opinion in Britain is still not on the side of bombing in Syria. I was looking at opinion polls this morning. Most people in Britain want to work through the UN and only to use military force as a last resort. Now, of course, if we wanted to stop ISIS, as you pointed out, we could cut off their funding. But as the Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister under Sarkozy, pointed out 2 years ago on French television, before the Arab Spring, before the uprising in Syria began, he was approached by British officials. He stressed that they were British officials who said that we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Now, what I would like Corbyn or somebody to ask the Prime Minister is, what role have we played in arming terrorist groups in Syria?
That's interesting.
The local forces,
Martin,
that the Prime Minister
has mentioned. It's interesting, it's been completely missing, really, from the discussions post Paris last Friday night.
Indeed.
Is what roles has the West played in creating ISIS in the first place?
Exactly. And of course, in the Middle East itself, it's fairly clear, if you're a citizen in Iran or the 80% of people in Syria who believe that ISIS has been created by CIA, MI6, because they did a YouGov poll recently, it's widely understood that our allies, Turkey, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, are the main supporters of ISIS. Now, if we really wanted to stop ISIS, we should cut off their supply line, which is exactly what the Syrian Arab Army is trying to do, and the Kurdish forces, which the Prime Minister mentioned. But those Kurdish forces are also in combat, as we speak, with NATO forces organised as part of the Turkish army. Are the SAS going to go in and shoot some Turkish generals for us? Because the Turkish generals would just turn around and say, your generals and our generals have had a coordinated plan here to overthrow the government of Syria. Even though the latest opinion polls inside Syria give Bashar al-Assad 55% of the popular support.
This whole business of going through the United Nations, it seems to have been rather sidelined this week and by David Cameron when he was asked on this specific question by Angus Robertson from the SNP at Prime Minister's Questions.
Sir Angus Robertson.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. In the wake of terrorist outrages and the ongoing civil war in Syria, it's very welcome that there is significant diplomatic progress in trying to find a solution to the Syrian crisis. The UK joined the United States and France and Russia and Iran at talks in Vienna at the weekend, and all signed a communique committing to progress through the United Nations. Will the Prime Minister confirm that he will support a UN Security Council resolution on this before seeking to intervene militarily in Syria?
Yeah.
I'm grateful to the Right Honourable Gentleman asking this question, because the point is this, that Russia has different aims to us, and they have repeatedly threatened to veto any such resolution. Now, of course, it is always preferable in these circumstances to have the full backing of the United Nations Security Council. But I have to say, what matters most of all is that any action we would take would both be legal and would help protect our country and our people right here. You cannot, as I said yesterday, outsource to a Russian veto the decisions we need to keep our country safe.
Well, this is begging the question, isn't it, all of this? The reason the Russians have also put in their own resolution to the UN Security Council saying, why don't we all agree to fight ISIS? And obviously the main forces which are fighting ISIS on the ground are twofold. One is the Syrian Arab Army. The other is the PKK-aligned Kurdish militias. Now, both of those groups are not acceptable to the Western powers. Now, I think public opinion in Britain understands that if we're serious about fighting ISIS, we've got to stop the fantasy of removing the democratically elected head of the Syrian government, Bashar al-Assad. We may not like him, or some people may not like him, but he has pretty much overwhelming support amongst the Syrian population. And many of those who demonstrated against him several years ago are now firmly behind him because they can see the alternative is worse. And when the Prime Minister goes on about legitimate moderate rebels in Syria, he is talking about Al-Qaeda Syria, the Al-Nusra Front, who have been provided with anti-aircraft weaponry by the Americans in the last few weeks. Are you happy about that? That your taxpayer dollar, Americans, is being used to supply anti-aircraft weapons to Al-Qaeda Syria?
But meanwhile, back here in Europe, this whole attack business has been connected immediately to Syrian refugees, although it looks like no Syrian refugees were involved in this at all. So it does look as if there are connections being made almost before the paint is dry or the print is dry on the newspapers.
Well, also, interestingly enough, there was a Wikipedia account of everything that happened in the attack, which went up before the attack took place. So somebody clearly had foreknowledge. The question is who? And what is very, very interesting...
Yeah, I saw that, and it was an IP address apparently in Britain.
Indeed. So, in other words, the
we'll put a link to that for anyone on our show page, thisweek.org.uk. We'll put a few links up about this.
And also Twitter accounts listing the casualties came out beforehand. Now, listen, this is not... This attack happens in a context. It happens in a context... Most people probably don't realise that there was an ISIS so-called suicide bomb attack, although it's not clear it was a suicide bomb attack, on Burj al Barajni in Beirut the day before the attack on Paris, in which 46 civilians were murdered. Have we been all going solidarity with the Shia Muslims of Burj al Barajni? No, we haven't. And as Assad himself pointed out, we have an attack like this in Syria every day. And we've had an attack like this in Syria every day for 4 years. But our army continues to fight, even though it's taken 60,000 casualties. And with the help of our Russian allies, we're finally squeezing these people out. Now, the obvious solution, if we're really determined to crush these kind of terrorists, is to align with Iran and with Russia and maybe overthrow the governments of Qatar and Saudi Arabia rather than selling them loads of weapons.
There was also Mehdi Hassan on Question Time last night was pointing out that the war in Yemen has taken thousands and thousands, actually in the thousands now, of children's lives. The Saudi Arabians have been attacking there. And not only that, what's happening there is they're actually supporting what they call the Daesh or ISIS over in Yemen.
Yeah, well, I mean, some might say, well, that's whataboutery, you know, that just because the Saudis are killing all these children in Yemen, why should we be more, you know, they've attacked us in Paris.
We've had hardly any coverage about that, and yet it's been wall-to-wall on Paris. It seems that
there was an attack by ISIS in Lebanon the previous day, which we've heard nothing about.
It seems like white lives in Paris are worth far, far more than ethnic minority lives over in places like Yemen or Lebanon.
Well, I mean, that sort of thing is inevitably true, but I think the evidence is piling up about this attack, as about previous attacks, like 7/7, like the attacks in Turkey. It was very interesting, because the Suruk bombing, which killed basically Kurdish political activists at a political meeting, the PKK is a very sophisticated organisation. It's been fighting NATO intelligence services and the Turkish army for 30 years. They immediately identified two Turkish intelligence officers, which they thought were responsible for the bombing, and assassinated them, which ended a four-year-old ceasefire.
Martin, what about the targeting in Paris? I made the point at the top of the hour about ordinary civilians being targeted. Actually, what's happening in France at the moment, politically, is that the people have been putting pressure on the government not to get involved with the US in Syria. And it does look like there's this kind of pressure, a much wider pressure, that the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad is something which is being driven by the Israelis, being driven by Washington, and Europe is being dragged into this too.
Well, I'm afraid in the French case, that's not necessarily the case, because Hollande has been actually, he led the charge on Libya. Do you remember a couple of years ago, everybody's out, oh, wasn't it brilliant that Gaddafi was stabbed up the backside with a bayonet and had his head blown off? That was a really great victory for freedom and democracy. And now, of course, then, of course, the Libyan stockpiles of weaponry were then transferred, probably by our own intelligence operation, by MI6, into Syria. And, of course, all the evidence now suggests that the chemical weapons attack was carried out by the al-Nusra Front, not by ISIS, the al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda Syria, with the help of the Turkish military and no doubt our own intelligence services.
So what's the purpose of targeting people in the street? That's not going to bring anyone over to your cause, is it?
No, the purpose of targeting people in the street, if you are the state, is in order to frighten the pants off them so that they then agree to do things that they wouldn't agree to do previously. If there was a serious attempt to fight back by ISIS, and ISIS were a serious organisation like the Provisional IRA, who nearly killed two British prime ministers, that's a serious terrorist organisation.
And what about reports of some of the shooters, eyewitnesses saying some of the shooters, both at one of the restaurant attacks and at the concert hall attack, actually being white guys, that they saw their faces, and one of them even apparently at the concert hall was blonde.
Well, do you know what my best guess about what happened here? You've got a series of patsies who've been set up, either consciously or unconsciously, to be the fall guys. So they're all dead, and they've all been identified by passports that they just happen to carry around with them. Although, of course, the passports can easily have been planted.
Well, actually, even the French police have said that.
Even the French police have said that.
Planted, yeah.
And then the actual killings and bombings are actually carried out by professionals. Professionals from Western security forces. That's what happened in Gladio. That's what happened, for example, in the Belgian supermarket massacres in the 1980s, the bombings at Piazza Fontana in 1969, probably the shootings in the Maidan Square. There's actually a track record of NATO carrying out these atrocities.
And what about
we've
heard it also, Bloomberg reporting exercises of mass killings going on Friday afternoon in Paris.
Well, that's another pattern that's the same, because what usually happens is there's an exercise of a terrorist attack, as there was on 7/7 in Britain, as there were several exercises going on in America on 9/11 of planes crashing into buildings, and then the exercise goes live. So what you've done is you've subverted the whole counterintelligence operation, counter-terrorist operation, and then you've carried out your attacks. And of course, as Vincenzo Vincinguerra, who's a fascist terrorist who was involved in the Gladio murders in Italy, said, of course we go for the innocent and the general population in these attacks, because we're trying to scare the pants off them. If you are a serious terrorist organisation like the PKK, they kill Turkish intelligence officers and Turkish soldiers and police officers. They don't kill innocent civilians.
Now, earlier this week, I spoke to former psychological warfare officer in the US Army, Scott Bennett, who also had questions immediately, pretty much from a forensic military point of view, about what really happened last Friday in Paris.
My background is a military officer working in the counterterrorism special operations community with a top secret clearance, and in psychological warfare, I've been involved with the terrorist missions and operations in the Middle East. And this Paris attack, I've had a lot of conversations with people who are researching it and analyzing it, and we've begun to look at the forensic analysis of the evidence and the environment, the shop, the tables, the blood, the people, the bodies, and we're looking at it from a military filter, and it's raising all sorts of questions. And I'll simply say, in combat situations, when you have explosions and bullets, especially from AK-47s, you have a lot more carnage and blood and bones and hair and scalp and clothes littered all over the scene than what we've seen in the media photographs and things of that nature. So forensically, it looks like it's very suspicious. It does not seem to be on the par that a traditional suicide bomb or a environment where bodies are shot at close range with an AK-47.
Well, it's interesting to hear Scott, who's a former psychological warfare officer, saying that. I think that there are plenty of people out there who've got more inside knowledge than I have to make those kind of comments. I would simply make the point that in Turkey, it's fairly clear that the Kurdish minority and most of the liberal sections of the population concluded immediately when the ISIS attacked the peace rally in Ankara and at Suruk that the Turkish intelligence services, MIT, were involved. They are part of NATO.
Okay, that's about three times you've said that now. But anyway, I did speak to Scott about his conversations with French intelligence after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and was wondering, did they actually take what he was telling them about how ISIS is being financed seriously?
Well, on March 27th, 2015, I had engaged with a conversation with a French intelligence officer in Washington after several emails about who I was, what my background was, what I knew, my experience with Swiss banks, and all the intelligence that had been provided to me. And I specifically reached out to him because Brad Birkenfeld, the Swiss bank whistleblower, who had 19,000 bank accounts, a lot of which were being used by Gulf nations in financing terrorism, money laundering, and drug trafficking, he was going to France to address the judges and some of the political powers about Swiss banks. And I had contacted French intelligence and said, you need to have these questions and this analysis presented when Birkenfeld comes and talks. I can't talk about it without a letter of request because there's military components. I had a top secret clearance, but I'm happy to do so as long as you go through the right channels. But all of these Swiss banks that Birkenfeld has been addressing, you need to analyze for terrorist implications, terrorist financing. And they didn't do a single thing with it. They never followed up. They never debriefed me. They never provided me the cover that I needed to be able to divulge what I knew. And they never asked Brad Birkenfeld any of the material that would have exposed a lot of the Swiss banks that were being used to funnel some of the ISIS operations. And he told me directly, it's in the video, my concern is for my homeland and my protection of citizens and protection of my soldiers. And I said, that's exactly what I'm concerned about, too. That's why I'm contacting you. But I can't talk to you about certain things. I have to meet with you, and I can only meet with you, and I can only talk about certain things if you provide me documentation so that, you know, I'm a former military officer. I've got to be very cautious. I can't be, you know, seen as doing anything out of the scope. And they refused to do that. They refused to engage, and they didn't follow up. And that was back in March of 2015. 8 months later, you've had this attack, supposedly, and they've done nothing about it. Now the question is, well, how much money was used to finance any of this operation?
Well, the Russians made this point at the G20. They gave their intelligence on where the financing for ISIS comes from. And, of course, no doubt they pointed the finger very firmly at Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, and quite possibly our own intelligence services. That's what people have got to recognise, because it's been going on for several years now. The attempt to overthrow Bashar Assad has been carried out by the Western Intelligence Services and the Gulf Cooperation Council and the Israelis by financing terrorist groups inside Syria. That's what's been going on. There's no doubt about it.
The mastermind of supposedly of these attacks, militant Abdelhamid Aboud, he was being killed in a police raid, and now he won't be asking any questions. But I mean, there's been a bit of profiling of him. He doesn't actually seem to be a terrorist. He's a pot smoking layabout, apparently.
Yeah, well, these pot smoking layabouts and drinkers, as they all seem to have been, these are classic patsies that are used in NATO intelligence operations. So these people are of Muslim origin, but they tend to have mental health issues or drug and alcohol or crime issues. They're then entrapped into being in the right place at the right time to end up being shot and taking the blame, but the actual bombings and shootings are done by people like Blackwater.
And I asked, also asked Scott Bennett about what he thought about the bigger picture. Let's see what you make of this, Martin.
The other thing is to look at it from a NATO perspective. Are they going to use this as a justification for the police state in Europe and the introduction of military forces to destabilize Assad in a reverse big Battle of the Bulge template. You remember World War II, the Germans pushed out and then were pushed back. I think the United States has been pushed out of the Middle East by Russia, and now they are perhaps going to use this to push back in.
I think that's a pretty shrewd analysis of where they think they're going with this. But the fact of the matter is that the Russian military and the Syrian military are winning the war on the ground inside Syria. And if the British want to go in and get a bloody nose trying to stop them, it's more fool them.
Is it really it's just as simple as the Gladio, Operation Gladio? And there's lots of documentation about that, where the US is trying to bamboozle Europe into joining it in the Middle East or somewhere else?
That is my copper's hunch about where we're at the minute on this. It's just too convenient that this attack happened the day before the Vienna conference was going to come to some political solution. There is no political solution in Syria without Assad, without Iran, without Russia. So any attempt to go and try and go in there and get ISIS without agreeing with the local forces on the, including the Kurds, by the way, who the West is now bigging up as the big fighters against ISIS. They are a Marxist-Leninist revolutionary organization, and the first thing they did after the Surat bombing was identified two Turkish intelligence officers who they thought were responsible and executed them, which then broke a four-year ceasefire. They've got an intelligence operation of their own. Most Kurds in Turkey are very well aware that the government of Turkey are 100% behind ISIS, and ISIS is 100% their creation.
Finally, Martin, if you want to bamboozle the media, the best time to do an attack is just after the show finishes, when the media goes home. Everyone leaves their job for 2.5 days.
Indeed. And, of course, the media have already got a narrative and ready to run with it, which they probably got from the Wikipedia article that appeared about the whole attack the day before it happened.
I noticed, for example, Gordon Carrera was straight on the BBC talking about Syria immediately, even though there was no evidence, and there still isn't, that this was organised from Syria.
Well, Hollande had a script to come out with immediately. This is definitely ISIS, we're definitely going to be pitiless, blah, 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 blah. You'd have thought it might have taken a while to work out what the hell had gone on.
Anyway, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Our sister show, Dialect, has been dropped for the time being from BCFM by the chair and the management, but it's still available as a podcast. So if you're online, you can download this week's show, which features interviews with former creative director of St Paul's Carnival, Jules Davis, sexual abuse survivor Sam Hill, as well as interviews with Helen Green and Nick Shipton from Bristol Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who've just returned from Occupy Palestine. You'll find this week's Dialect on dialectradio1word.co.uk. Thanks to our guest Anna McMullen. Also thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and to Kevin Phillips from the Police Federation. You'll find us links online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend, and as usual, don't let those banksters get you down.
Live from the Sky News Centre.